So we are in 1 Samuel again, our final study in 1 Samuel. And so we're in chapter 30 where we left off. 1 Samuel 30 verse 21 will be our starting place. And it's just hard to believe we come to the end of 1 Samuel. It didn't seem like that long we've been studying it, but it has been a few months, I'm sure. And we're also, as we come to the end of 1 Samuel, we're coming to the end of King Saul's reign. And we'll look, as we look at our study today, we're going to see actually kind of the rise and fall of two kings. We're going to see David is sort of rising as king. He's starting to come up as king, and we see Saul falling away. So we'll start with David then, as David is again moving into that position as king. He's not quite there yet, but he's on that trajectory. And just from review from last study, remember David had been staying in the land of the Philistines. They give him a city, the city Ziklag. And but then the Philistines, thinking David was now their ally, called him up and his men to go fight with Israel. But after he gets to the front line, they send him back. Well, it takes like 3 days' journey to get from the front line back to his city. And in that time, the Amalekites came and they attacked and burned the city and carried all the people off. It says no one was harmed, but they're all taken captive. Well, with God's direction, David and his 600 men set out to rescue these people. So they rescue their people. It's their families that have been taken. But remember, 200 of them were too tired to continue the journey. And so they stopped there at the brook Bezor, or the ravine Bezor, which was, you know, we think of a brook, we think of just a little stream that you can step across, but it wasn't like that. It was a pretty difficult terrain to cross over because it was like a big ravine that'd be washed out with the spring floods and such. And so David with the 400 men, they battle and they're successful. Now they're coming back, and that's what we're picking up today. Now they're coming back. David and his 400 are returning to the 200 who stayed behind. And they've got all the families of all of them with them. And they've also got all this extra booty now, because they not only got back their stuff, but they got back all, they got all the stuff that these other towns had lost and the Amalekites raided them. So they just kind of increased their wealth in that. And so let's read here in 1 Samuel 30, verse 21. As we see David stepping up as king, it says, "When David came to the 200 men who were too exhausted to follow David, who had also been left at the brook Bezor, and they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. Then David approached the people and greeted them. Then all the wicked and worthless men among those who went with David said, 'Because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except to every man his wife and his children, that they may lead them away and depart.' Then David said, 'You must not do so, my brothers, with what the Lord has given us, who has kept us and delivered into our hand the band that came against us. And who will listen to you in this matter? For as his share is who goes down to the battle, so shall his share be who stays by the baggage. They shall share alike. So it has been from that day forward that he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day.'" And so among that 400 that was coming back with David from the battleground, there were those who didn't want to share the booty with those who didn't actually fight, those who tired out and stayed behind. I mean, they even kind of suggest there, in around verse 22, I think it is, that they just leave. You know, take your families and go. You know, we don't need you anymore. Kind of treating them almost like they're traitors or something. And you can kind of see their logic, you know. It's like, these guys didn't fight, they didn't do the work that we did, so they shouldn't share in the bounty that we have, the reward that we have, they think. And we can see their point a little bit. It kind of appeals to a fleshly sense of fairness, you know. I mean, no work, no pay. But we also have an expression, even in our culture today, that there's no I in team. And a team is not about selfishness, but it has to be about selflessness in order for it to function well as a team. In 2004, we had a lesson in this from the USA men's Olympic basketball team, as this star-studded team finished with a bronze in the Olympics. And this was a really disappointing finish, because these were all NBA stars playing on this team. I mean, the NBA is the premier basketball league in the world. And because of this, it led to a new strategy in the Olympic basketball for the U.S. men, and that is they'd focus on building now cohesive teams and not just having like the best players. It doesn't matter how good those individuals are if they can't function well as a team, if they can't play together. It takes a team to win a basketball game. And King David knew that in order to have a successful military, it was a team thing too. It was a team project. You couldn't have this dissension in the group. You can't build a strong military or a strong nation on selfishness like this, where people are, you know, kicking people out and keeping the booty and all this kind of thing they wanted to do. Every member needs to be equally valued and appreciated. You know, it's not so much about what each role people do either. I mean, every role is important, is what David's saying. And that's true today too, in the church. We think about how it is in the church today. I mean, every member of the church, you know, I'm thinking of the church worldwide, not just in this room, has a part to play. And every part is essential to the success of what God is doing in this world. Not everyone has the same roles. Not everyone has a role that others even see. You know, there's a lot of people that are, you know, occupying prayer closets and that sort of thing that are doing the heavy lifting of the ministry, in fact. But every piece leads to the victory of the whole is what happens. And that's why as Christians, you know, when we see another Christian who is excelling in some way and having a ministry or a witness to the world in some way, we rejoice in that. We're not jealous of that. We rejoice that, you know, the Lord is having this greater impact through this servant of theirs. David was also perhaps reflecting this proverb in his decision here from Proverbs 20, verse 28. Proverbs 20, verse 28 says, loyalty and truth preserve the king, and he upholds his throne by righteousness. And so, you know, for David's throne to be secure as he's going to become king, loyalty and truth and righteousness are essential ingredients to that. That's what you want. Not this sort of dissension and people mistreating other people and all this kind of thing. There needs to be loyalty and truth and righteousness. And that's true, you know, really today too. Anyone in leadership, those are the kind of traits you want to see in a group that you're over or in a group that you're leading. You certainly want to exude those traits yourself. But next we're going to see David as he's kind of rising up as king. We're going to see him reaching out as king. Let's read from 1 Samuel 30, verse 26. It says, now when David came to Ziklag, he sent some of the spoil to the elders of Judah, to his friends, saying, behold, a gift for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord, to those who were in Bethel, and to those who were in Ramoth of the Negev, and to those who were in Jadr, and to those who were in Aror, and to those who were in Sifmoth, and to those who were in Eshtemoa, and to those who were in Rakal, and to those who were in the cities of the Jeremelites, to those who were in the cities of the Kenites, and to those who were in Hormah, and to those who were in Borashan, and to those who were in Athek, and to those who were in Hebron, and to all the places where David himself and his men were accustomed to go. And so David, through all these various cities he's listed, that probably, you know, sounds like alphabet soup as I'm saying it to you, because they're not real familiar to us. But as he's sharing with them, he's sharing the victory with more of Israel. He doesn't share with all of the nation, but he's sharing with really primarily focused in Judah. Because remember, the Amalekites had actually taken from some in Judah. We studied that last time too. When they were doing their raiding, they had actually gone through and taken some from peoples in Judah also. But David's not just sharing with those that were taken from in Judah. He's sharing kind of all over the hill country of Judah. He's sharing this wealth. And even some to the south in the Negev, it says, based on the locations mentioned. And so this was showing David's loyalty was still to his people, you know, to Judah, which was the tribe he was from. And so he was showing his loyalty there. I mean, if David really was intending to live amongst the Philistines and if he was, you know, now an enemy of Israel, which we know he's not, but if he were, he wouldn't share the loot like this with them. You know, he wouldn't send it back to them. He'd just keep it all himself. Or maybe give it to his, you know, Philistine king or something like this. But it just reflects David's heart was still back with his people. You know, he wanted to bless them because they'd received so much from the Lord. He's like, we can't keep all this to ourselves. We need to share this you know, with others who are in need also. But I'd suggest to you, it wasn't all heart in David's decision here. There was some head involved here too in this decision, because really this was a smart political move for David to do this, to share like this with all these peoples. It showed that David had amassed power, that he had become a powerful leader there, even though they weren't seeing him, that this had happened. Distributing gifts like this was a sign of power in the Near East when someone would do that. Someone in a position of authority would do that. Something a king might do is share, you know, plunder like this. And so David is setting the stage for his own rise as king. He's giving them confidence in him. Look at all this plunder I've taken. I'm just going to share it all with you guys because I've got so much from, you know, this military conquest. He's spreading some goodwill amongst the elders of Judah. And the thought there would be that, you know, them having benefited from David like this materially, you know, from David's generosity, well, he might expect then that when he makes his bid for king that they're going to support him in that. You know, they're going to say, yeah, David, he's great. You know, we want David. He's generous. And so there is somewhat of a political move there. I don't think it's like all ulterior motive, but it was a smart move on his part, you know, to do this as well. In everything we've talked about so far, though, we definitely see David's favor as king. He's being favored by God. David's victory, from which he's sharing these spoils, was at God's direction. I mean, he said that back in verse 23, in his rebuke to the men who wanted to keep everything. He said, you know, how can we keep everything the Lord has given us? He says there in verse 23, it was the Lord that had given it to him. And we studied last time, earlier in chapter 30, how David had sought the Lord in all this before they went out after the Amalekites. And David obeyed the Lord in attacking them. And God is honoring David's faithfulness and David's obedience to him. He and his men, remember, were grossly outnumbered by this group. I mean, this group of Amalekites was a huge group. The number that escaped were 400, which was the size of David's army that attacked. So, I mean, that's the ones who escaped. We only speculate maybe there were 2,000 soldiers there because it took them a whole day to complete the battle. It was a long battle. But through that blessing, God now is paving the way for David to claim the throne. Through that plunder, David now passes on like this to Judah. And remember that, you know, this idea of David being king wasn't a new one. God had anointed him back in chapter 16 for this role. He anointed him king way back then, as when God, you know, said, you're going to be the next king. The Bible tells us in Proverbs 13:12, I think this verse will be familiar to you, Proverbs 13:12, that hope deferred makes the heart sick, but desire fulfilled is a tree of life. And, you know, David's had that hope deferred for quite a while now. You know, 10 years is a long time. You know, God told him he was going to be king, and then now what happened? You know, just waiting and being chased by Saul and all this stuff. And so he definitely had gone through that deferral there. And I think we can make a case that there was some heart sickness there. I mean, the very fact that he was living amongst the Philistines was that he had gotten kind of discouraged and just thought, well, I'm just going to go live with them. Because if I stay here in Judah, you know, he kind of lost faith there. I'm eventually Saul's going to get me, you know. So he left and went to the Philistines, which definitely was not him walking, you know, in strong faith at that point. But now David is beginning to see this fulfilled, his rise to be the king. And maybe you can relate to David as I'm talking about this proverb. You know, maybe there's been a desire in your life that's been fulfilled. And it's in such a clear way that it's from the Lord. And we just can't help but rejoice. I mean, it's so awesome when that happens, you know, when the Lord provides in that way. I mean, it's something we've waited for, something we've prayed for. Or today you may find yourself waiting and you're in that point where that hope is being deferred a little bit. But I just want to encourage you, like King David did, to hold on. You know, don't give up hope. Wait for God to move in your situation. I found in my life that, you know, I never regret when I waited for the Lord to answer, you know, a prayer concern I had. I never regret when I wait for that. The only time that we experience regret is when we try and find the answer for ourselves. You know, we go on our own plan rather than staying with God and waiting for His plan. Because God's plans are always better than ours. God's plans are perfect. You know, and our plans, as good as they may be, are never perfect, you know, because we're not perfect. And they always fall short of God's best for us. And so it's so wise for us to wait, you know, for God's best, for God to bring it about in His time. So we're seeing David here. We're seeing him begin to step up into this role as king and kind of prepare the way. But there's one thing still in his way, and that's King Saul. But that's not going to be for long. King Saul will not be in his way for long. The battle we've been looking at, approaching for the last two studies we've been together, is now finally here. We've seen Israel and the Philistines lining up for battle. Israel is at Jezreel to the south, and the Philistines are at Shunem to the north, and there's this plain in between them. And Israel is actually their camp. It's kind of in the mountains of Gilboa. We studied that before too. And we saw in previous studies how Saul's fear just overwhelmed him before this enormous Philistine army. We've seen this army is like thousands that are coming against him. And in his fear, you know, he reached out to God, but, you know, God is not hearing, he's not hearing from God anymore. He turned away from God a long time ago. And so basically that phone's been hung up, you know, and God's not answering him. And so his fear then drives him to the occult. And he goes to the woman at Endor, and she was a medium. And, you know, Saul had actually been cleaning up Israel and you know, putting to death, really, all these mediums and getting rid of them. And so against his own law, now he comes to her and asks her to bring up Samuel for him, the dead prophet who this book is named after. And to the woman's shock and horror, Samuel actually shows up. It's a miracle of God that Samuel actually shows up. You know, it's like, that's never happened before, nor will it ever happen again, but it happened there. God allowed it to happen. And Samuel had a prophecy for Saul, and he prophesied that Saul was going to be defeated that next day. And what we're going to see is that prophecy is going to take place, that Saul and his sons, from chapter 28, verse 19, is where that was prophesied, we're going to die in this battle. And so let's read about the battle, beginning in chapter 31, because this battle, as we're going to see, goes terribly. Chapter 31, verse 1 says, Now the Philistines were fighting against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. The Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines killed Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. The battle went heavily against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was badly wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor-bearer, Draw your sword and pierce me through with it. Otherwise these uncircumcised will come and pierce me through and make sport of me. But his armor-bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. So Saul took his sword and fell on it. When his armor-bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him. Thus Saul died with his three sons, his armor-bearer, and all his men on that day together. When the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley, with those who were beyond the Jordan, saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned the cities and fled. Then the Philistines came and lived in them. And so Samuel's prediction of defeat, we see, is fulfilled here. Saul's sons, first of all, die in the Gilboa Mountains. And this reflects the fact that the Israelites were retreating. We kind of read that the men of Israel, in verse 1, fled. And then they fell slain on the Mount Gilboa. I mean, the idea was they were going to fight on this plain in between the two camps, but because the Philistines were so much more powerful, Israelites are running into the hills, literally, being killed there. And so Saul's sons died in those mountains where the Philistines had pushed them. And remember that the Philistines were a mighty warring group as a nation. And one of the things that made them so impressive and so terrible to fight against was they had iron weapons before other people did. They had learned how to smelt iron and make these implements. And one of the things that they made were iron chariots. And so they had iron chariots. And to us today, we think about a chariot, we think, well, you know, it's just a cart with some horses. I mean, what's the big deal about that? Well, imagine if you're standing on the ground and someone is riding on a chariot with, you know, a team of horses in front of them. You can see how that's going to be a pretty difficult situation for you to handle, you know, from the ground militarily. I mean, they essentially, in ancient times, were like tanks. I mean, it was like a tank back then is really what it was. And it gave them a clear advantage on that plain. I mean, they probably just drove right through there with those chariots and the Israelites running, you know, from in front of them to get away. But the Philistines not only had chariots, like an army you would expect, they had archers also, which are the ones who shoot the bow and arrow. And Saul is wounded by their arrows, it says. And to the extent that he knows he can't get away, he's not going to be able to escape because the wounds are too bad. And so Saul asks the unimaginable of his armor bearer. He asks him to kill him. He wants him to kill him right there on the spot. How sad this is. This is Saul at the end of his life. You know, this is what we see of Saul. There's no peace there. There's no resolve. There's no faith in God. You know, he just wants someone to put him to death. You know, I mean, it's so sad. All we see there is fear. And I would suggest this is the plight of those who reject God, like Saul had done. Saul had rejected God many years before this. And, you know, while you're in the prime of life, all seems fine when you have your health and you think you have many more days to come in that rejection against God. But at the end, you know, when you realize this is it, well, there's anguish there. There's going to be doubt. There's going to be fear when a person doesn't have a relationship with God. And that's why it's so important that we have that relationship with God. For anyone who does not, that hears me, that we give our life to Christ. We don't want to come to the end like Saul here with nothing but fear. Well, his armor bearer, you know, is a godly man. He's not going to kill him. He refuses to kill Saul because to do so would be murder. You know, to kill him like that would be murder. Saul was not the enemy on the battlefield. Saul was his king. And so for him to kill him, he recognizes, I can't murder this person. Now, there are certain times that killing is not breaking the sixth commandment. You know, thou shalt not kill, or more correctly, thou shalt not commit murder. One of those times that killing is permissible, if I can use that term, is in war like this. You know, when people go to war, it's expected there's going to be killing, unfortunately. Another example of when, you know, killing is allowed is by a governing authority as corporal punishment. You know, that's allowed too. We see that in the book of Romans talks about that. But any other taking of human life, even if the other person asks for it, like Saul is asking for him to do this, is murder. It's just plain old murder is all it is. And so, you know, the armor bearer doesn't want to commit murder, first of all, but then secondly, this is God's anointed. We've seen over and over how David was not willing to touch God's anointed. I'm not going to harm him. He's God's anointed. It's like you got to keep your hands off of God's anointed, right? And so this armor bearer reflects the same thing. I think this would really be the source of his fear, probably. It says he's afraid. He's like, I can't touch this guy. You know, no way. He knows that if he strikes down God's chosen king here, that, you know, it's not going to go good for him. You know, there's going to be something in kind for him coming down the pike here. Just like David, you know, this was really to sin against God's order is what it would be. I mean, when you kill the one that God has put in place, I mean, whoa, you know, how much against God's will can you be? And so what tragically happens is both of them end up taking their own lives. They commit suicide. You know, such an ugly thing to see and even think about. And, you know, although it's very twisted, we can kind of understand why Saul did this. He wasn't a great man of faith to begin with. We know that. We've talked about that in previous times. And he told us really already why he did this too in the verses we read. That he was afraid of what was going to happen to him if the Philistines came upon him. And in fact, there were real reasons to fear that, because at that time, a fallen king would be made sport of. I mean, they weren't going to treat him nicely. It wasn't going to be one blow and it's over. They were going to really torture him. Kings, when they were caught, were often mutilated by the captor. You think about the story of Samson, when Samson was caught and how they put out his eyes. Well, that sort of thing is what they would do. They might cut off their thumbs and their big toes to make them have a crippling experience. They might, put a hook in their nose, as they drag them around. They do all kinds of just terrible, awful things to a fallen king like this. But they wouldn't kill them. They kind of keep them alive as kind of like this pet. Let me show you. Here's the king of Israel over here. I've got an exhibit A in cell number one or whatever. To live a life of humiliation after that. I mean, it was like the ultimate attack against your enemy to make them live out the rest of their days like that. It was terrible. But why would the armor bearer follow suit? We understand why Saul didn't want to go through all that, but why would the armor bearer follow suit? Well, it doesn't really tell us why he did this, but clearly he would not have done that if Saul had not done so first. I think it's safe to say. And so Saul, even in his last moments, rather than pointing to the truth of God, actually led this man in error. I mean, it's so sad. Right up to the end, Saul was just a terrible spiritual leader, really not a spiritual leader at all. And of course, suicide is something that never should be done. And so, this is a terrible thing any way you look at it. Verse 7 records then that with Saul and his sons dead, that the people that weren't even in the battle, the Israelites who were kind of looking on, said, we got to get out of Dodge. So they retreated far away so that they let those houses and that property that was nearby, they're just like, you guys can have that. That's yours. The Philistines moved on in there and apparently stopped chasing at that point. Next, we're going to look, though, at Saul's shame as we read a little more in our verses today. From 1 Samuel 31, verse 8, it says, it came about on the next day when the Philistines came to strip the slain that they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. They cut off his head and stripped off his weapons and sent them throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to the house of their idols and to the people. They put his weapons in the temple of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan. And so Saul's shame here. I mean, Saul's body now and his weapons become a trophy for the Philistines. Particularly the head of an enemy was a prized trophy and was used to boast of military success, as barbaric as that is. And so his head and his armaments are paraded around the Philistine kingdom to, celebrate, that they had defeated the king of Israel. It's sort of this twisted pep rally that's going on here amongst the Philistines. And then the bodies were hung publicly. And this would be done both as a sign of disgrace, on the Israelites, and also a sign of terror. I mean, look at what we did to the king of Israel. And they were hung at Bethshan, which was a tall mound along a trade route that went into the Jordan Valley. So it was a very public place, and people could easily see it. You didn't have to search it out. It was on a main route where people would see it. And it's really this display of power by the Philistines. Look what we did. This is what we can do. Don't mess with us, basically, is the message you're supposed to take from that. And then Saul's armor is made as an offering to Ashtaroth. Now, the Philistines had many gods, like the other nations around Israel back then. And we studied, actually, from 1 Samuel 5, we studied Dagon. And this was that half-man, half-fish god that we studied that kept falling over in their temple there. And he's kind of where we get the idea of a mermaid, especially his female counterpart, the goddess. Looks like we would think of as a mermaid. But Ashtoreth was the goddess of all things sensual and of war. Kind of interesting combination there, kind of god of both those things. And so this armor would have been given as an offering there. I mean, clearly they see it as, this goddess of war is why we were successful. And so we're making an offering to her with these armaments of Saul. And it reminds us a little bit of how, David, took Goliath's sword and ended up in the temple, at one time before he took it back. But the people of Jabesh Gilead, we haven't talked about them in a long time, they hear what's going on with Saul and they're not content with this. Let's read a little more. Actually, we'll finish the verses in 1 Samuel, verse 11. It says, now when the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men rose and walked all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bethshan. And they came to Jabesh and burned them there. They took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days. And so this is really a tribute to Saul now, is what these men do, these brave men, because they engaged in really a risky recovery operation to get these bodies like this. This was a great risk to themselves. And why is Jabesh-Gilead significant? Remember Jabesh-Gilead, we studied about them back in chapter 11. Saul's first military victory was actually rescuing Jabesh-Gilead, which had fallen under siege and all that. He came to their rescue. And so they haven't forgotten that. And now they're coming back to, you know, they couldn't rescue Saul himself, but they can at least rescue his body from this disgrace and his sons as well. And so to do this, do this recovery operation, they had to travel, we estimate, between 15 and 20 miles, which is significant distance, you know, on foot to get to Beth Shan. And they had to go through enemy territory to get there. So this was a dangerous journey for them to make. And they even had to cross the Jordan River in that. And so this was no small trek that they made. And then once they got there, they had to get the bodies off the wall and then repeat that trek to go all the way back to their home in Jabesh there. And so this was a very risky thing for them to do. They could have been caught. It could have cost them their own lives, but they did it and were successful. And when they get back home, then they burn the bodies of Saul and his sons and then bury the bones. Now, burning like this was not a normal practice in Israel. You know, that wasn't the normal way. Normally, they would embalm a body and then put them in a tomb. And we're all familiar with that. And we talk about that at Easter time. We talk about Jesus' burial and such. That's what they would have normally done. But we figured that basically what happened with these bodies is that they were so badly decomposed and in such bad shape that they really couldn't embalm them. And so they just did this to sort of clean things up. And then they just buried the bones. Because that's what Israel would do anyways, eventually, is they would take the bodies after they had decayed over a year and nothing was left but bone. They would take those bones out of the tomb and put those, bury those or put those in an ossuary box or whatever. And so they buried these bones beneath a tamarisk tree. And this is kind of poetic that they put them under a tamarisk tree like this. Because back in 1 Samuel chapter 22, in Saul's life, we saw him as king when he was reigning as king there, choosing to sit under a tamarisk tree as he was executing his duties as king. And so it's almost poetic then that they buried him under a tamarisk tree like he seemed to enjoy in his lifetime. Then they fasted for 7 days for Saul and his sons. And, you know, in the law, after touching a corpse, there were requirements for a person to become ceremonially clean again, because that would make you unclean. You couldn't, engage in rites at the temple and that sort of thing after you had touched a corpse for 7 days. But to cleanse yourself, all you needed to do was on the 3rd and 7th days after touching the corpse, you needed to wash. And that's how you became clean. There wasn't anything else special you had to do. You certainly didn't have to fast like this for 7 days. That's a pretty long fast that they did. And so this fast is really a touching thing. I mean, these men, and we get the feeling that more than just these men, did this out of respect for Saul. And really it was a time of mourning for them, that they were mourning for his death and the death of his sons. And so thus was the end of Saul's reign. Saul's reign as king came to a bloody end, you know, a pretty horrible end. And it was the end of his family. You know, none of them were going to sit on the throne either. Now, there was a descendant, we'll find out later, that's still out there, but they would never rule again. But there's kind of a detail that we've skipped over so far as we've gone through these verses, and that is, you know, it's kind of disturbing to us that, you know, godly Jonathan gets caught up in all of this. You know, Jonathan is mixed up in this battle and dies there. And that kind of raises a question in our minds. I mean, how can this happen? You know, how can this righteous man fall like this with the sinful? I mean, every picture we see of Jonathan in 1 Samuel is just amazing. I mean, everyone wants Jonathan as their friend. You know, he's brave, he's loyal, I mean, he shows all signs of godliness in this man. That's all we see coming out of him. And so how could he be cut down like this? You know, he's fighting for, you know, admittedly his wicked father, but he's also fighting for his nation. I mean, how could this happen to him? And, you know, the Bible doesn't promise that the righteous will be shielded from difficulty and even death. And that's what's happened to Jonathan, isn't it? He wasn't shielded from it. He experienced it too. We don't have to think too hard to find other such examples in the Bible of godly people that went through some terrible things. We think about the prophets in the Old Testament, so many of which who were martyred as a result of their ministry. You know, I mean, you're trying to minister to these people and they put you to death. I mean, that's terrible. And yet that happens so many times. You think about the apostles in the New Testament. You know, all of them were abused and all but one were martyred as well. And these were, you know, God's chosen instruments. You know, these were God's people that he was using. And so bad things can and do sometimes happen to God's people. It's just a fact of life that we have to accept in this world. It's a fallen world, and we're not always spared from the results of that, the consequences of that. The Bible does promise, though, that even in these things, God works for our good. We're all familiar, probably, with Romans 8:28. That says that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. And so he does work those things for good. The problem is that we tend to think that good is always going to be in this life. You know, we always think that there's always going to be, you know, a silver lining in this life. And that's what that good means. I mean, you know, this is what we know. This is where we live. You know, we live in this world. We haven't lived in heaven yet. Although all of us as believers will live in heaven someday. But if you think about it, coming home to the Lord is the ultimate good we're looking for. I mean, that is the ultimate good that we all hoping for and expecting or looking forward to someday. And so sometimes this good is accomplished in ugly ways. I mean, that's what happened to Jonathan. It was accomplished in a very ugly way, a way that we would have never predicted. On a bloody battlefield, he stepped into eternity. In any case, even though these things are very difficult for us to grapple with, we can always trust that our Father knows best and that he's always just and good in what he does, even when we don't understand why things are happening the way they are. Let's close in with a word of prayer. Lord God, we thank you that you are the faithful one, that we can always trust what you're doing, even when it's confusing to us, even when it's not what we would like. We can always trust in you, and help us to do that, Lord. We need your power to really trust you and have faith in you, God, on the good days and on the bad days. And we just thank you that we can trust you like that. And we thank you for 1 Samuel. We thank you for the way you've spoken to us through this book of the Bible, such an awesome book, and we've just enjoyed it so much. And we just ask, Lord, for your guidance over our lives this day and this week. We want our lives to make a difference for eternity. And we know that's only possible by your Spirit. And so we pray your Spirit's working in and through us this week. In Jesus' name, amen.